Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from California to West Virginia, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming around the planet on radiopower.org, whiterosesociety.org, out of airamericaradio.com, and in 29 states on digital TV systems on CRN Digital, CRNI.com. Welcome back to our program. 6 minutes past the hour. Coming up today, Iraq, Iran, China, and Big Brother. What's up with this? Michael Abelman, founder of the Center for Urban Agriculture at Fairview Gardens, is going to be with us. Education and Organic Farm Center in Southern California. What's interesting about this is if peak oil hits, if everything falls apart, how much land do you need to feed yourself? What can be done? Right now, Tamara Drought is with us. Tamara is the author of a new book, Strapped, Why America's 20 and 30-somethings Can't Get Ahead. And she's actually here with us live in our studio in the People's Republic of Portland, Oregon. Tamara, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
Great to have you. Strapped, how are America's 20 and 30-somethings different from the 20 and 30-somethings of 30 years ago, say?
Good question. Well, why don't we get to the heart of it, which is income. So if you look at what the typical 25 to 34-year-old college grad is earning in the labor market today, they're actually earning about the same after adjusting for inflation or a little less. But think about all the things that have grown much, much, much faster than inflation. Housing, cost of a college education, child care. Meanwhile, young people without college degrees, if you look what they're making, the typical 25 to 34-year-old, no bachelor's degree, they make about 10 grand less per year than they would have 30 years ago, and that's after adjusting for inflation. So right away, they hit the labor market, they're not making as much money as their parents did, and over time, their earnings aren't growing as quickly either.
How did this happen?
Well, you know, I think one of the things we have to look at is the quality of jobs has declined. You know, everybody knows we lost the manufacturing jobs. 30 years ago, GM was the nation's largest employer. They were unionized. They paid $18 an hour. They had benefits. Today it's Walmart.
Which would be that $18 an hour 30 years ago, by the way, would be like nearly $30 an hour in today's dollars, I would think.
Well, that's the 18, I think, is
adjusted. Oh, 18 adjusted,
yeah.
Okay.
Yep. So we've seen a sea change in our labor market. At the same time, we've had aggressive anti-union legislation at the state level. The federal watchdogs have just completely dropped the ball in terms of enforcing the legal right for people to unionize their workforce. So both those things, the loss of high-paying blue-collar jobs, they're just not around for this generation like they were for the previous generation. The lack of unions, and then at the what's happening to young professionals is a little different. There's just a lot fewer middle management jobs than there used to be, and that began, you know, in the lean and mean downsizing of the 80s, which many of our parents suffered through. What that means is young people are going to be stuck in the entry-level jobs much longer than they would have a generation ago.
Are you familiar with the writings of Strauss and Howe? They wrote The Generations of America or The Fourth Turning?
I am. They blurbed my book.
Oh, great. Good on. Well, in their writings, they suggest that there are these four generational cycles in the United States,
yep.
And that each generation has an equality, which is a function of the generation before it, and that kind of sets up how they're going to be. And every fourth generation, we have an economic disaster and a generation that lives through it. And then as a consequence of that experience, they produce a generation of children who have another world experience and so on. To what extent do you think that what we're experiencing now is simply that generational turning? Are we in the fourth turning? Are the 20 and 30-somethings of today the 20 and 30-somethings of 1929?
I think in many ways they are. And what they point to is that the up-and-coming young adults, what they refer to as the millennials, some people call Gen Y, the sort of 22 and younger, are supposed to be the great hope for getting us out of this economic blight and turning things around in this country. However, I'm a little more cynical than that, only because, you know, we have these cycles of history that supposedly whenever, you know, corporate power gets too too much and has too much influence on our political and personal lives, there should be some sort of countervailing pressure. And, you know, we just haven't seen those countervailing pressures take place. And young people, by the way, are often way too tuned out and not involved in the political process to sort of be the lever for change that can sweep in some countervailing measures. So I keep waiting for the pendulum to swing back. And I'm not, you know, we had Enron and Global Crossing, and college debt is up to $20,000, you know, to go to your standard four-year university. I'm waiting for something to give, but
I think it's happening. I think it's happening.
You might be more optimistic than me.
I'm seeing it leaking out the seams all over the place, and particularly, Republicans calling this program, for example. But we're talking with Tamara Drouch. She's the author of Strapped, Why America's 20 and 30-somethings Can't Get Ahead. Tamara, what's your solution for this problem?
Well, one of the things that I hope to accomplish with the book, and one of the main reasons I wrote the book, is to let young people know that what they're dealing with in their individual lives is connected to a much broader social economic system that has really changed since their parents were our age. Far too often, I call it the Reaganization of an era. You know, we grew up being told everything was our personal responsibility. If we weren't getting ahead, it was our fault, that government was the problem, not the solution. And so we have a whole generation that has just been paralyzed into thinking and connecting their issues to the larger system. And I want to connect those dots. I want to urge people to get involved and let them know that, you know, they can make a real difference.
The Reagan memes have really sunk in. I think the 15 years of right-wing talk radio has had a lot to do with it as well. But they really have sunk in among people who are largely, say, under 35, who came of age during the Reagan and the first Bush era, and even Clinton. I mean, even the Clinton administration was still using the Reagan memes. We're going to end welfare as we know it. We're going to reduce the size of government. They were internationalized, globalized, all this stuff. How do you reach? One of the things that has really concerned me is I travel around the country a lot. And I speak on these topics. I've written a bunch of books, and I go in and do book signings or do book tours or whatever. And I'll come into a community, and people will show up, and most of them are my age. I'm in my 50s, and most of them are in their 40s, 50s, and 60s. They're the people who remember, like I do, or were part of, like I was, the anti-war and the civil rights movements in the 1960s and early 70s. And I see very few people under 30 years old showing up for these things. And the few who do, by and large, tend to be there with their parents. And so how do we engage? Now, so I guess there's two questions here. Number one, is that just I'm an old fart showing up, and if I had been 25 years old, the room would be full of 25? I mean, for example, you're much younger than I am. When you show up, do you have young people who show up in droves for these kind of things? Is that number one? Or number two, is there actually a political disengagement of this generation that you're writing about?
I think it's both things. There's definitely a political disengagement. But I do. I've been overwhelmed. I've been out on my book tour, and I'm hooking up with a lot of organizations that reach young people. Mm. You know, just to give an example, I did something in Minneapolis with the Citizens League there, and we had 250 people, which was overwhelming. In Boston, 150. So
these are people under 30.
These are people under let's say under 40. Mm-hmm. So I think that young people are the book is resonating with them because it's telling them something they haven't heard before, which is, hey, this maybe isn't all your fault. Mm-hmm. There's actually, you're living through a fundamental shift in our country, and it's resulting in choked opportunity, stalled mobility, and here's what you can do to change things.
Right. We have about a minute and a half left. Tamara Drouch, the author of Strapped, Why Americans 20 and 30-somethings Can't Get Ahead. Tamara, what are your specific solutions?
Well, we got to end the debt for diploma system. You know, it's choking people with 20 grand in debt and keeping a lot of bright young kids from modest backgrounds from getting the college they want and deserve. So we've got to do that. We've got to create better jobs. We have to enforce the right for workers to unionize. And finally, we need to help young families. We're the only country that doesn't provide paid parental leave or any type of subsidized child care. So we've got a lot of catching up to do.
You sound like Franklin Roosevelt.
Well, I mean, there are worse people to sound like.
I know this is. It's like it's coming back around. It's just remarkable. It's marvelous. I mean, this is the future of America. Is this generation? Is and we have to galvanize them. We have to wake them up. So the book Strapped, the author Tamara Drought, Why American 20 and 30 somethings Can't Get Ahead. Social contract. We don't need no stinking social contract. Say the conservatives, Tamara, very quickly. How do you rebut that?
They wouldn't be where they are today without it. I mean, we have the our public infrastructure makes the enormous amount of wealth possible. So it's time that we realize that those who get ahead got ahead because we invest in our people.
There you go. Well said. Tamara Drought, Strapped, Why Americans 20 and 30, America's 20 and 30-somethings Can't Get Ahead, the book. It's 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartmann radio program defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Be right back.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartmann.
Well, I won't back down. No, I won't back down. You can stand me up at the gates of hell, but I won't back down.
There you go, my friends. It's the Tom Hartmann radio program where despair is not an option. You got to get active. You ever heard of Kibluz? No, you probably haven't. CFIUS. I'm not sure how to pronounce that. How would you say it? Cafius? Cafius? Anyhow, CFIUS. What is CFIUS? Well, it is the Transportation Department's what would you call it? Well, let's just call it by its name. Committee on Foreign Investments in the United States. It is the Transportation Department's group that determines whether or not foreigners are allowed to buy things that have to do with the Transportation Department, or the Treasury Department, excuse me, in the United States. This is the Treasury Department's Committee on Foreign Investments in the United States. And as Ellen Ratner notes today on WorldNetDaily.com on her Liberal and Proud column, this is fascinating. Ellen dug this thing out, and it's just amazing. This is the group that authorized the sale of six American ports to a company from the United Arab Emirates, the UAE. It is chaired by Treasury Secretary John Snow, the former head of, he was, before he became the Treasury Secretary, he was the head of CSX Corporation, and he was also chairman of the Conference Board, which is the round table of 100, the CEOs of the 100 largest corporations in the United States. And so here you have John Snow, the Treasury Secretary. And what did he do with CSX before he took the job of Treasury Secretary in 2004? Well, he sold CSX's foreign port assets to Dubai Ports World, the company that is talking about buying these six ports in the United States. So he, in his company, when John Snow was running one of the largest companies in the United States, one of the largest companies in the world, frankly, CSX Corp, big shipping company, he sold a bunch of his foreign port assets to Dubai Ports World. So why shouldn't he sell ours, right? And David Sanborn, you probably haven't heard of David Sanborn. He's the administrator at the Transportation Department's Maritime Administration. He's the guy who is in charge of helping make this decision about whether or not we can sell our ports to foreign companies. And it's not just foreign companies, obviously, because the ports have been owned by the British for some time, by a British company, but it's not a state-owned company. It's a privately held company. A lot of conservatives are making that distinction. I'd make an even larger one, which we'll get to in just a second. Anyhow, before he took on this job as the Transportation Department's Maritime Administrator, before he took on that job, he was the head of American and European operations for Dubai Ports World. Yeah. So Ellen says the Bush administration's motto should be salute the flag and cash the check. And I'm telling you, that's the case. That is so much the case. If you look, by the way, at P&O Ports, which is the company that Dubai Ports World is buying, they don't just own ports in the United States. They own ports in Australia, New Zealand, in the UK, in the Philippines, in China, in Argentina, in Russia, in Indonesia, in Pakistan, in Thailand, in Mozambique, in Sri Lanka, South Africa, Belgium. The list is starting to get redundant here. Baltimore, USA, Antwerp, Belgium, Chennai, India, Australia, Vancouver, Canada, Chebang, Thailand, France, Mundra, India, and on the list goes. This is just from their website, pohub.com. And so what is this really all about? What it's really all about, and by the way, this company is also going to end up with control of the traffic going through the courts, through the ports of Beaumont and Corpus Christi. P&O, the company that's being acquired, has just renewed a contract. It's from the British paper Lloyd's List. Has just renewed a contract with the United States Surface Deployment and Distribution Command to provide stevedoring, that's loading and unloading of military equipment, at the Texas ports of Beaumont and Corpus Christi. So through 2010. So starting next month, the company that is going to load and unload 40%, roughly, of the American Army cargo going to Iraq and Afghanistan is going to be based in the United Arab Emirates. Is it starting to get weird? What this is part of, my friends, and here's the bigger issue that the conservatives won't tell you about. There's a bunch of Republicans who are getting their panties in a wad about this thing, and the reason why principally is because it plays poorly on TV. They don't like the fact that they're being outed about this. What this is really about is the $1.3 trillion sellout of America just last year. I mean, it's just absolutely mind-boggling, the companies, the size of the companies and the volume of the sales that are happening of American-based companies to and American-based assets to foreign, to overseas companies. And you can just go through industry by industry and look at it. Publishing and printing, for example, Harcourt General is bought by Reed Elsevier, United Kingdom, $5.6 billion. Simon & Schuster was bought by Pearson PLC in the UK, $4 billion. West Publishing, Thomson Corp in Canada bought them for $3 billion. Macmillan Inc. was bought by Maxwell in the UK for $2 billion. Houghton Mifflin, bought by Vivendi in France for $2.2 billion. What, and that's just publishing. I mean, we can pick an industry, and you can just go through all the companies. Why? Because the conservative economic policy, starting with Ronald Reagan, of selling out this country to the biggest multinational corporations, have bankrupted America. It's 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Radio operator, do you ever think of me? 'Cause I'm a gleam on some horizon, just too far away to see.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on the True People's Radio. Sikorsky struck by 3,600 Teamsters. This just in. Nearly 3,600 Sikorsky aircraft employees in Connecticut and Florida went on strike yesterday, blaming higher health insurance costs and the company's contract offer as the reason for their walkout. I'm telling you, the failure to produce health insurance to consider health insurance a right in the United States. 37 major industrialized countries in the world, 36 of them have universal health care. We don't. The failure to do that is making America not only non-competitive with the rest of the world, it's making us the laughingstock of the world. But back to this issue of this port, because this has caught the attention of the mainstream media. And you'll recall, we were talking about it here on this program weeks ago. But now it's, a week and a half ago anyway. But now, now everybody has noticed it. And I got to say, when the Bushies come out and they say, there really is no security threat to the United States. Having a company that was having a company owned by the royal family, which essentially owns a country that had connections, shall we say, with 9/11. When they say that there's no security threat, they're actually right. The Bush administration is actually telling the truth about that, because it's not, you know, owning something, by and large, particularly something as regulated as a port, simply means you get to skim the cream off. You get to take the profit home with you, which is my issue. I mean, this is the thing that they're not going to tell you. And this is why, frankly, I think the Bush administration is going to get into this thing. And I think they're going to try and stop it because it's doing political damage to them. But people are looking at the wrong part of the picture. They're saying, oh my God, we're letting a company from the United Arab Emirates buy our ports. I'm sorry, a British company already owned our ports. The question should be, why are we selling off America? And the answer is because there's a whole lot of people out there who are sitting on U.S. dollars and they have to put them someplace, and you can only spend them here or use them to buy oil. Which, by the way, raises a whole other issue about what happens if Iran gets the, you know, in March, they get their oil bourse and this oil trading floor, and they start denominating oil in euros. Because the reason why, I mean, we have an $8.1-something trillion debt right now, and Bush is going to have to raise the debt ceiling in the next 3 months because he's bumping up against the top of it. Consider that, an $8 trillion debt. Before Ronald Reagan came into office, we had never had even a $1 trillion debt in the United States. And the only president since Reagan to have given us a balanced budget was Bill Clinton. So the bottom line here is that what we have is the selling off of America. It's economic treason. And it is being done in the name of conservative economic policies and this idea of globalization. Total foreign ownership of the U.S. federal deficit currently stands at 45%. Japan owns $687 billion of our debt. China owns $252 billion of our debt. The United Kingdom owns $182 billion of our debt. So they're buying our debt. Plus, we're buying more stuff from the rest of the world than we're selling to the rest of the world. And as a consequence of that, the rest of the world is ending up with a whole bunch of our dollars. What are they going to do with them? If we want to buy all kinds of junk at Walmart that was made in China, and all these dollars go out of the United States, and they float around because China uses them to buy oil from Dubai, and then Dubai uses them to buy, you know, contracting from England, and now England's got the money. What are they going to do with these dollars? They come back to the United States, and they say, we'd like to buy Amoco Corporation. And sure enough, for $48 billion, British Petroleum bought Amoco Corporation. We'd like to buy ARCO Corporation from you. It used to be called the American Oil Company, I believe. ARCO Corporation, it was bought by BP in the last 10 years, $27.224 billion. We'd like to buy a chunk of Texaco. We'll take their refining operation, Shell. Of the Netherlands bought that. We'd like to buy a piece of Pennzoil, the Quaker State Company. We'll take that. That is Shell bought it in the Netherlands. Saudi Refining bought some of Texaco's refining operations. We'll look at telecommunications. Vodafone Group in the United Kingdom, they bought AirTouch Communications, $60 billion. Deutsche Telekom, this is the German, I mean, this used to be the state-run telephone company. $29.4 billion. British Telecom in the UK for $5 billion bought AT&T's worldwide assets operations. Chrysler Corporation, Germany comes in and says, hey, you know, we got $40 billion. Daimler-Benz buys Chrysler for $40 billion. I already shared with you the publishing thing. In mining, BPH in Australia buys Magma Copper Company, $2 billion. Kennecott of the UK buys Nerco for one. These are companies that are probably not so familiar to you. Flextronics of Singapore buys the D2 group for $2.5 billion, electronic and electrical equipment. John Hancock Financial Services, named after the guy who signed the Declaration of Independence, bought by Manulife Financial Corporation in Canada. Trans-America Corporation. Sounds pretty American, doesn't it? Sorry, a company in the Netherlands bought them for $9.6 billion, Aegon NV. How about Farmers Corp Group, Inc.? That sounds pretty American. A bunch of American farmers, right? No, that's now owned by Batis, Inc., BAT Industries PLC in the United Kingdom. They paid $5.2 billion for it. Well, what about Cigna? It's a big insurance company. Aren't they American? No, they're owned by the Belgians. Excuse me, they're owned by the Bermudans ACE Corp. Limited. What about American Bankers Group, American Bankers Insurance Group Incorporated? It's owned by Fortis AG of Belgium. They bought it for $2.6 billion. Providian Corp. Insurance. They were bought by Aegean NV in the Netherlands. IBM's hard disk division, bought by the Japanese, by Hitachi, for $2 billion. Kingston Technology, that was bought by the Japanese, by SoftBank, for $1.07 billion. Amdahl, bought by Fujitsu, for, you know, $900 million. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. You go to economyandcrisis.org, and I'm looking, I've got about a 15-page list here. And these are billion-dollar deals. This is the selling off of America. That is the real story here. And here's where it gets even weirder. In today's Wall Street Journal, a Thinking Global column by Frederick Kemp, he starts to say it's called Protectionism Threatens the Emerging Engine of Growth. Right? This is the world is flat, the Thomas Friedman people's worldview. This is the let's have global free trade, it's going to solve all our problems worldview. And what they're saying is, yeah, we've noticed that America's been going in the tank for the last 20 years since we started this global free trade thing, but don't worry, there's somebody coming to the rescue. Well, here's the article, as Frederick Kemp says. He says, imagine the American consumer is a fatigued soldier, having guarded global economic growth through the past decade against all attacks, yet new enemies threaten from every direction. Inflation, indebtedness, property bubbles, energy prices, terrorism. Mercifully, the cavalry is on the way to provide relief. But it isn't coming from the rich countries of Western Europe. The savior isn't even a resurgent Japan, he writes. The source instead is emerging markets, where consumers from Beijing to Bucharest bought like never before in 2005. They accounted for some 40% of global imports, or $4 trillion. That share is four times as large as it was in 1990 when globalization was taking hold. He's right. The Chinese are becoming a huge market. They're buying stuff. And not just the Chinese, all of these third world, what formerly were third world countries, where our country, our companies are now going and setting up shop, or in the former European countries, where European companies are going to set up shop to get cheap labor. And the standard of living in those countries is going up, and they're building consumer middle classes. And so, says Frederick Kemp in the Wall Street Journal today, or he suggests, actually, so we should think this is a good thing, because eventually they're going to get around to saying, you know, since we're buying stuff for our middle class, we want to buy things made in America. Why would they do that? Why would they want to buy something made in America? Why aren't they simply going to go to the next cheap labor country? And he doesn't point out in his article anywhere where that 40% of world trade being sold into developing countries is coming from, because it's not coming from the United States. We have gone from being the leading exporter in the world. When Ronald Reagan came into office, we were the leading exporter in the world of finished goods, of manufactured goods. That's the definition of an industrialized country. We were the leading importer of raw materials. We brought in iron ore, we made steel, we made cars, and we exported them. We were the leading importer of raw materials and the leading exporter of finished goods. We are now the world's leading importer of finished goods and the world's leading exporter of raw materials. We have become a third world nation by definition. And it's because of these insane economic policies. How do you solve the problem? Very simple. You walk away from the WTO. You walk away from NAFTA. You walk away from CAFTA. Bush did it with the Kyoto Accords. He did it with the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. You can walk away from a treaty. You can simply say, I'm unsigning it. It's just incredible here. This Frederick Kemp's column in today's Wall Street Journal. I read this thing and just get, he says, protectionist forces in Congress and Europe could stymie this most promising new aspect of the global economy. Yes, we could stop outsourcing all our jobs to them. We could stop building their middle class. That would be a terrible thing for the multinational corporations who are profiting from it. He points out one-third of U.S. corporations' foreign-affiliated income came from emerging markets, a record high. Yes, American companies, they're making out like bandits. Why? Because they're buying companies, or they're owning companies, or they're building companies in these countries. But is it helping you and me? No. 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number way in Gilroy, California. You are live and on the air, sir. Hey, Wayne.
Hi, Tom.
Oh, ma'am, yeah. I'm sorry.
That's okay. My husband and I were talking that this whole port idea, that being an election year and all, just a theory, that what if it's, you know, being brought up by Bush, and then if the Republicans, you know, they throw legislation on him, and he has to back down, he looks like a good guy, and then they look like a good guy for standing up for the people.
Well, that's the thing. They can throw Bush under the train right now, because they don't need him politically anymore other than to raise money, and he'll always be able to show up in any community and raise money from the hardcore base who believes that he can do no wrong or who has a single agenda. You know, he'll always draw the anti-abortion crowd. He'll always draw the whatever. That small slice, you know, he's always going to draw. And so what's going to happen, my take on what's going to happen, is the congressional Republicans in the House and Senate are going to stand up and say, you know, enough of this already. We can't have this happen. Bush is already, essentially the administration is saying, although yesterday they were very careful to say, this hasn't gone to the desk of the president, which is their way, Bush's way of saying, I don't know what's going on. I got nothing to do with this. Don't blame me. But in any case, they're going to say, we're going to overrule the bureaucrats in the executive branch. John Snow and the Treasury Department and all this. We're going to overrule them and we're going to make this not happen. And they probably won't succeed. But whether they succeed or they don't succeed, the Republicans in Congress are going to position themselves like, we're strong on national security, even though it looks like they took on Bush. And I don't see any downside to them in the political calculus of that. And they will successfully keep Americans from talking about what I'm saying over and over and over here again is the real issue, which is the selling off of America.
Right.
So, Wade, thanks a lot for the call and for raising that issue. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Where East meets West, hopefully.
Yeah.
You know,
We just went from California to Pennsylvania in a half a second.
Yeah, I tried to hear you when I was down south. I just could not find a radio station. I don't know what market you're in Florida, but anyway, I just think the bottom line here, if you will, is obviously I've always felt and I still feel more strongly than ever that wealth, too much wealth, unfortunately, is undermining everything.
Well, it's not so much too much wealth. It is the concentration of wealth in too small a number of hands.
Well, okay, right. That's what
we're talking about. You know, the United States.
The playing field is not level here.
Right, right. We have concentrations of wealth in the United States right now that are like we haven't seen since 1929. It's just absolutely like we haven't seen since 1929. Tom, and thank you for the comment, Gary. Tom in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, Tom.
Hey, Tom, quickly, I wanted to mention the USA Today article, but on this, the cavalry coming to rescue us, these emerging markets you're talking about.
Right. And then Frederick Kemp is talking about in today's Wall Street Journal.
Right, and they use the phrase, prosperity is around the corner, just be patient. Didn't we hear that phrase before 70 years ago from Hoover?
Yeah, that was Herbert Hoover's campaign slogan, prosperity is just around the corner.
Depression.
Yeah, the Republican Day. Thank you, the Republican
Day. And I wanted to mention, Bush is not running in 06. We have to say the Republican leadership, the Republicans, Republican Congress, that tag has to be the Republicans and constantly. And I'm looking at this USA Today article about the federal budget, and then, you know, they have our view and an opposing view.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill Frist has the opposing view that tax cuts make money, blah, blah, blah. And then the USA Today view is trying to say how funny the party of small government is actually, you know, bringing us into debt. And all throughout this article, they say members of Congress, Washington, they never say Republican. They say, you know, the all representatives, my God.
Well, that's because USA Today is essentially a conservative publication.
But he's criticizing the Republican Congress, but never puts the word Republican in front of the Congress.
Right. Well, of course. Of course.
But then why is he...
Are you surprised, Tom?
No, but he's criticizing the Congress.
I know. If it had been a Democratic Congress, the word Democrat would have been in there. that they were criticizing. I'm not at all surprised by it. Tom, thanks for the call and for pointing that out. I appreciate it. Charisse in Paulsboro, Washington?
Yeah.
Hey, Charisse, what's up?
Hi. Hey, I was watching a rerun of C-SPAN Sunday night at 1 in the morning, and there was a meeting with Stabenow, Carl Levin, and Dorgan. He was chairing the meeting, and it was with the car manufacturing people, and they were complaining about our trade policies with Korea, China, and Japan, and, you know, what you've said a million times, how unequal it is and how they manipulate the dollar. Japan specifically, they were complaining about, and how they import such a tiny amount of our stuff that 98 to 99% of all the cars in those countries are homemade. And then they had leaders from the car parts manufacturers. And, I mean, it was an amazing hearing. And Carl Levin was just railing on these people who were defending our trade policies and everything.
Well, it's because he represents Michigan. He gets it.
Well, yeah. But I was just wondering, I was really in a bad mood Sunday because of this whole port thing, and this made me feel so much better that, and that's the benefit of watching C-SPAN. At least you see that the Democrats are doing something, that there are hearings being
held. Oh, they're trying as hard as they can. They're just beating their heads against a wall right now.
I know, but at least they're doing something. At least you don't think, well, they're not doing a thing. I mean, I know it doesn't get them anywhere, but it's comforting to know that they care enough to haul these people in and swear them in and question them. But
no, they're doing the best they can, Charisse. The problem is that the leadership of the Republican Party, the leadership of the Senate and the leadership of the House is Republican, and they will not hold hearings on these things. They will not talk about these topics. And thanks for the call.
Sure.
And I appreciate your watching C-SPAN as well, by the way, in addition to our program, listening to our program, because C-SPAN is one of the last bastions in the United States of actual access to what's going on in our democratic process. And it's under attack, by the way. There is an effort, an organized effort, as part of a reform of the Telecommunications Act to strip out the provision that requires cable companies to offer access to things like C-SPAN. Well, C-SPAN is a consortium of the cable companies. It's basically a tax on the local cable companies, and they want to take that out. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friend. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Gee, can you outsource? You can't outsource a board op job to India, can you? I don't think so. Sorry about that. Welcome back to our program. Presidents like pork, too, it says in the Wall Street Journal Online. In search of presidential earmarks. Turns out George W. Bush has been putting, you know, he's out here ranting about earmarks. Earmarks are these little flags, these appropriations bills that say, we're going to appropriate, $1 million for libraries. And it can only be spent at the library at the corner of 4th and Main in St. Louis. That's an earmark. And Bush is saying, you know, this is pork. These earmarks are pork. And this is how individual members of Congress make sure the dollars end up in their districts, or that the lobbyists who have, I guess bribed is too strong a word these days, but I think of it that way. The lobbyists who have helped their campaigns, shall we say, are appropriately rewarded. But in the 13 appropriations bills that George W. Bush put forward or signed in fiscal year 2005, he put 15,877 earmarks into them. Yes, you heard it right. 15,877 earmarks. This, according to the Wall Street Journal, there's the Laura Bush 21st Century Librarian Program, for example. Which this year has, this from an article by Jackie Combs, which this year has $24 million for grants to train people for the First Lady's former profession. From the fiscal year that starts in October, Mr. Bush seeks $10 million for Preserve America grants for communities' historic preservation efforts, $50 million for the Help America Youth Initiative, programs championed by Mrs. Bush. Although the Education Department's budget is going to be cut, Bush proposes a 16% increase to $204 million for teaching what? Science? No, we're cutting that. Math? No, we're cutting that. The reading? No, we're cutting that. Foreign languages? No, we're cutting that. No, $204 million to teach sexual abstinence in our high schools. A teaching, by the way, a way of teaching sex education that has been demonstrated to increase the number of unintended pregnancies and thus the number of abortions. Although you don't have to worry about that because the Supreme Court today decided to take on a third trimester abortion case, which is the beginning of the end of Roe v. Wade. The president's $5.3 billion request for the Army Corps of Engineers includes scores of proposed water and wetlands projects. The administration always wants specific things, says Republican Richard Shelby, Senator Shelby, who is a member of the Senate Appropriations Committee and chairman of its Subcommittee for Commerce, Justice, and Science Programs, is practiced at earmarks for his home state of Alabama. I guess you could call it whatever you want to. Yes, earmarks. George W. Bush putting 15,877 earmarks in the 13 appropriations fiscal bills for fiscal 2005, nearly four times the number in 1994, near the end of Democrats' long majority control of Congress. Actually, not, these aren't entirely, but these are the Republicans. They say the president's earmarks are harder, if not impossible, to tally. Many appear in only in closely held supplementals separate from the public budget books. But a lot of them go into Mrs. Bush. A lot of them going to Mrs. Bush. Also over at thinkprogress.org, by the way, Scooter Libby has launched a new website. If you would like to contribute money to the defense fund of Scooter Libby, it is up and running on the web at scooterlibby.org. And, in fact, right across the very top, Scooter Libby is one of the most capable and talented individuals I have ever known. Signed, Vice President Dick Cheney. He's got quotes from Bush. He's got quotes from Wolfowitz, from Britt Hume. That's amazing. Absolutely amazing. Meanwhile, I just want to get back for a moment to this issue of the economy, and then I want to move along to healthcare as well. These are the issues of our day, my friends. I'm telling you, there is nothing bigger. What is the Bush administration going to do about the fact that we are facing now a $726 billion trade deficit last year, and this year is going to be even worse? Now, what a trade deficit means is that we buy more stuff than we sell. Now, selling stuff is how we get income, right? It's how money comes into the United States. So a trade deficit is sort of like the United States and the rest of the world, the relationship between the United States and the rest of the world. If our income from sales equals our purchases, then it's sort of like your paycheck equals all of your bills at the end of the month. You don't put any money aside. You don't end up with so much money that you can buy your neighbor's house and then rent it back to them. But you do, it's incredible. The Bush administration's approach to this thing is going to be that they're going to try and attack the Chinese for manipulating currency. They're going to say, the Chinese are just messing with the currency. Don't, you know, that's all. The administration's new tough approach with China could involve filing trade charges over auto branding and copyright piracy and branding the Chinese as currency manipulators, writes Martin Krutzinger in the Associated Press. However, some bet that the harder line won't have much effect, at least right away, on the soaring U.S. trade deficit, which hit an all-time high of $726 billion last year. So anyway, it's like we're spending more than we're bringing in. That's the bottom line. That's what a trade deficit is. We are spending more than we're bringing in. We are spending, well, last year we spent $726 billion more than we brought in. So where do we get the money to spend $726 billion more than we brought in? We sell off part of America. Now, in the case of the government running a deficit, the way that they get the money, see, there's two different deficits here. There's the trade deficit and there's the government budget deficit. In the case of the budget deficit, This is where Bush wants to have money to fight his war in Iraq, okay? So he wants to spend federal dollars. But he's got a 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, I mean, it depends on the year, right? It's hundreds of billions of dollars, and it depends on whether or not you add in Social Security. If you add in the Social Security Trust Fund money that he's borrowing, Bush is spending about $600-700 billion more than the country is bringing in taxes. So where does he make that money up? He borrows it from other countries. That's when we sell treasury bills. But the trade deficit, you don't borrow money for. With a trade deficit, the way that we buy more stuff from the rest of the world than we sell to them, it has to balance out eventually. And the only way that we can balance it out is to sell them America, is to let them come in and buy the United States. And thus we find these companies, buying up our land. Now Bush wants to sell off hundreds of thousands of acres of federal lands. And who's going to buy it? Well, probably the UAE, probably Saudi Arabia, probably China. You're going to end up with China owning Yellowstone if Bush keeps going this way. One-fourth of our trade deficit last year was with one country, China, $202 billion. So these conservatives in Congress who aren't willing to acknowledge what the real problem is say, well, this is because the Chinese are manipulating their currency. They're keeping it undervalued. And so Chinese stuff is cheap in the United States. It's 40% cheaper than it should be. They want the Chinese to increase the value of their currency by 40%. Well, they could do that. Although the Cato Institute, Dan Griswold, the trade expert at the Cato Institute, says, this would be a tax increase on low- and middle-income Americans. They're the ones who are buying the shoes and clothing and toys coming from China. Well, yeah, it would increase the prices to them. But if it brought jobs back to America, good-paying jobs, I think they'd be happy with it. But in any case, Schumer and Lindsey Graham, for example, Chuck Schumer and Lindsey Graham, are suggesting across-the-board penalty tariffs of 27.5%, 27.5% on Chinese goods. But this is just an indiscriminate tariff. This is a penalty tariff. Well, first of all, it's not going to go anywhere because China now has us by the proverbial short hairs. I mean, they are in a position where all they have to do is just squeeze a little bit, and the whole United States could go ah, because if they just stopped buying our billions and billions of dollars of debt every year, forget the trade deficit, the budget deficit is being financed by the Chinese. Not to mention the trade deficit is with the Chinese. And so, you know, they've got all this cash of ours. They could destroy our economy. And we know it, and they know it, and they know that we know it. Because they've threatened it. So, you know, Schumer and Graham, they're going to go around, they're going to talk about a penalty tariff. Why not go back to the old-fashioned tariffs of saying, listen, if it costs a dollar, if there's a dollar's worth of labor and a pair of shoes made in the United States when they're made with a, you know, $18 an hour good union job, and that same pair of shoes made in China has 10 cents worth of labor at, you know, $2 a day, then we put a 90-cent tax on that pair of shoes when they come into the United States to level the playing field for labor. So it still costs a dollar for the labor. This is how we did it for 200 years. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
When I was just a baby, my mama told me, son, always be a good boy, don't ever play with guns. But I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die.
Yes, yeah, you should have had a conversation with Dick Cheney.
When I hear that whistle blowing, I hang my head and cry.
And welcome back with friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Imbalio in the chat room, which you can get to, by the way, by going to TomHartman.com and clicking live chat. He says, we have to say no to our addictions like Toyotas and Sony. It takes discipline and a love of country. Even if we have to buy a Chevy with some Chinese parts, it's a start on the road to freedom. I respectfully disagree. It's not about what we buy here. It's about the policies that this government follows that determine what we can buy here. We'll get back into that in more detail after the bottom of the hour and be taking your calls. Right now, Greg Gorman is with us with Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com in Washington, D.C. Hey, Greg, welcome to the program.
Well, I'm glad to be here, Tom. Always a pleasure.
Thank you. What's happening in Washington, D.C. today, Greg?
Well, a few things are happening. You know, Congress is out, but we've heard from Bill Frist, who has has sort of made it known that he doesn't approve of the ports deal that we talked about last week, that's being run by a Dubai-based company that wants to manage six of the major ports in the United States.
They don't want to manage them. They want to own them.
Well, they want to own them. And Bill Frist has said that he is going to bring up legislation next week when Congress comes back in session to block that. He's now added his weight behind other GOP members, in addition to the Democrats, who are going up against the president to try to block this. I was in New York City last weekend, and which is not a very political town on a general basis, and I can tell you that I even had friends who were talking about this. You know, we hear from Senator Schumer, who's also trying to do legislation in New York, and Representative King of New York is trying to do the same thing. So, you know, it looks like the president is going to be stopped on this, at least in the short term.
Well, and in fact, you know, yesterday on all the news shows, they were saying, well, this hasn't yet gotten to the level of the president. This is still at the level of the bureaucrats in the Treasury Department.
Oh, I think that's what they'd like people to believe, but I don't believe that for a second.
Yeah, well, and it doesn't matter. I mean, the fact of the matter is Bush is not running for re-election in 2006. He's not running for re-election in 2008. And so the Republicans can afford to run against Bush in ways that don't harm the Republican Party and win. I mean, they'll come out looking really good for this. But fundamentally, what we have here is the outcome. This isn't just about, you know, port security. This is about selling off America. And the reason that we're selling off America is because we have no choice. And the reason we have no choice is because we're so badly in debt to all these other countries that the only way that we can balance that debt is by having them buy our country. And the reason for that is because of the insane trade policies that started out with Ronald Reagan and then George Herbert Walker Bush and then Bill Clinton signing NAFTA and GATT and now George W. Bush that
Tom,
are throwing us into this huge trade deficit.
Tom, you know, I've said it once and I'll say it again. You are a genius. You have picked up on what everyone in Washington is saying. This whole deal by Bill Frist, he's trying to look like he's going up against the president when in reality he's starting his presidential campaign. This is an issue that he thinks that people in the middle of the country can really get behind. And if he goes up against the president, he's trying to keep us safer. It's a campaign ploy in 2006 for 2008.
Right, and they'll do it in a way that won't actually hurt Bush. It'll be like Reagan used to run against the bureaucrats in Washington. And, I mean, even when he was president, Reagan was running against Washington, D.C. And he was actually able to pull it off. I mean, after he'd been president for 4 years, he was able to run on the policy of I'm an outsider, don't elect somebody who's an old-time politician. You know, and he's been governor of California, he's been president of the United States for 4 years, and he's running on an outsider platform. Bush will do the same thing. Bush and Frist will do the same thing. Bush will take the position of, this is terrible what these bureaucrats in the Department of the Treasury have done. Come, you know, mark my words, Greg. This is not, you know, and Churchill, it's the weak spot for the administration on this is that they let Chertoff, well, they put him out on Sunday on the talk shows and said, you know, you got to clean this thing up here, Brownie and all this stuff. And Chertoff, somebody asked him a question about the port thing, and Chertoff says, oh yeah, we took care of that. We made sure that everything is safe. Nothing to worry about there. And now they're spinning that because he's probably going to be the guy who's going to bite the bullet on this thing.
Well, that's what I actually heard the same thing, and that seems to be sort of a consensus now around town. You know,
he never shut up in his mouth.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, quickly, the other big issue is the court was in session today. I was there this morning. There were two big cases on water rights issues, and one pretty interesting decision on peyote that you know you may have heard of. On 8-0, the court has decided. Justice Alito did not participate in this case. 8-0, they said that the government cannot hinder the use of peyote or of a tea called Hosca that has hallucinogenic.
It's pronounced ayahuasca, actually.
Oh, how do you say it?
Ayahuasca.
Ayahuasca, okay.
Ayahuasca.
Yes, and so it's, as I've been saying all morning, it's one for the little guys. They've won.
Yeah, yeah, interesting. That's, yeah, a good friend of mine leads groups down to Brazil to participate in ayahuasca ceremonies. And another good friend of mine is, in fact, probably one of my very best friends, is engaged to a Brazilian woman, and her family has been part of one of these churches for several decades. It's semi-Catholic thing. I mean, they get together and they drink this hallucinogen, basically. It makes you throw up. They go out and throw up, and then they hang out in church for 8 hours, and they're singing prayers and singing songs and tripping. but that's their sacrament. You know, they've got a cross up there on the altar with a plant, with a vine growing around it.
That's right. And according to the court, now 8-0, they can continue to do that all they want.
That's amazing. I'm impressed. The libertarians will be happy with that.
Yes, they will.
So interesting. Greg Gorman with the Talk Radio News Service. Greg, thanks so much.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
Always great having you here. It's talkradionews.com is Greg's website. It's 27 minutes past the hour. TomHartman.com, our website. We'll be right back.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
I felt so good, like anything was possible. Hit cruise control and rub my eyes. The last 3 days, the rain was unstoppable. It was always cold, no sunshine.
I know that feeling. Broadcasting live from the People's Republic of Portland, Oregon. Welcome back to the radio support group of, by, and for We the People. Tom Hartman here with you. 34 minutes past the hour. 1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number, 440-THOM. TomHartman.com, our website. If you want to drop by to our live chat room, just click the live chat link. If you want to participate in our message boards, and you too can blog. Or comment, or all of the above. You're welcome to drop in there. Nate in St. Cloud, Minnesota on the line. Hey, Nate, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Great show. Very informative, as usual. I was just going to... Oh, and that reminded me. You ever hear that O'Reilly guy, whatever? He says, who's looking out for you? I think you are.
Thank you.
I really mean that.
Well, I appreciate that, but you know what Mr. O'Reilly has to say about that?
All those clowns over at the Liberal Radio Network, we could incarcerate them immediately. Will you have that done, please? Send over the FBI and just put them in chains? Because they, they're undermining everything.
There you go. Yeah. So our thought for the day from Bill O'Reilly. Anyhow, Nate, you were saying.
Yeah, I was going to make one more quick point and then ask a question.
Sure.
I remember you were, while I was waiting to talk, I remember hearing you say about how Reagan came into Washington and as an outsider into politics.
Right. He always ran as an outsider. That was that was his whole persona.
One thing I think I remember learning was that one of his campaign promises was that he would look into the impact that secret societies have on politics, and he never did that, and I just thought I'd throw that out there.
Okay.
You might want to check in on it.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
Okay, and then...
You had a question.
Yes. Those treaties and trade agreements, I thought I remember you saying sometime before, weeks ago maybe, that those treaties and trade agreements are in a way more sacred or held higher than our own Constitution here because they're international. And I was just wondering, how does that fit into what you said about how we could just come out of them anytime we want to?
Well, the situation is that the Constitution says that a treaty has, I have the Constitution here in my hand right now, and I'm trying to find it, but I'm not sure exactly where it is. It's in here. Anyway, it's in here somewhere. It's a national debt, submitting the Constitution. In any case, the Constitution says that if we sign a treaty, then that becomes the law of the land. So, for example, if we signed a treaty with Canada, if the United States signed a treaty with Canada that said that anytime you eat pancakes, you have to, by law, put Canadian maple syrup on it, or the police can come and get you and take you off to jail.
Okay.
If we signed a treaty that said that, then, and let's say that treaty had nothing to do with maple syrup. It had to do with anything. I mean, we signed a treaty to buy some lumber from them or to buy some oil from them. They're actually our largest supplier of oil. And as part of that, now that would be probably a trade deal. But let's say we signed a treaty. If it was officially a treaty and it was approved by Congress, then that would mean that even though your state doesn't have laws like that, and even if your state tried to pass laws like that, that would become the law of the land. A better example, here's a more actual, real example. For 25 years, the Humane Society of the United States and various animal rights groups worked to outlaw the practice of using these drift nets, these mile-long nets that go a half a mile deep into the ocean, where they would see, to, for tuna. Because what they would do is they would see, whenever there's a school of tuna fish swimming, they're deep down in the water. They're a half mile down. But dolphins, for some reason, and I don't frankly know the reason, but you know it's probably out there easily found. Somebody can Google it or whatever. Dolphins swim above schools of tuna. It might be that the tuna are, you know, wherever they're going, there's a lot of fish to eat, and so the dolphins want to follow them, or the dolphins eat the leftover from the tuna's feeding, or whatever. I don't know why. But fishermen know that if they see a school of dolphins, then all they have to do is put a giant net around it and scoop everything up, and what's way down below is going to be a whole bunch of tuna, and they're going to kill the dolphins, but they're going to get the tuna. And they did that for decades. And the Humane Society and other groups were concerned about this. The dolphins are mammals. They're intelligent. They were being killed off like this needlessly. And so we passed a law in the United States that said that it's against the law to do that kind of fishing. You just can't do it. And all the tuna manufacturers in the United States, you know, rushed to put dolphin safe on their labels and everything, and it was a really cool thing. And then we signed NAFTA, the NAFTA treaty. And the NAFTA treaty says that you cannot pass a law, a federal law, that diminishes the ability of another country to compete with you. In other words, you can't pass a law domestically that forces another country to have to change the way they do things if they're going to compete with you. And so Mexico sued us saying when we go fishing for tuna, we take out the dolphins too. And that tuna is not dolphin safe, right? And so under the law that we had passed after 25 years of agitation by the Humane Society, that Mexican tuna fish couldn't be sold in the United States. The NAFTA got together, an Article 11 of NAFTA tribunal, three-person tribunal, representatives of multinational corporations on these. These are not elected by anybody. These are appointed by NAFTA. The big corporations get together, and you have representatives of the governments and of the corporations, and ruled that the United States law was in violation of NAFTA, and therefore it had to be struck down. And so today it is illegal for the United States to say that it's illegal to kill dolphins when you're getting tuna. And, I mean, this is the insanity of it. And so the bottom line is that if you want to back away from that stuff, and by the way, that's why so many conservatives are so upset about the United Nations, because joining the United Nations involves signing treaties that say, for example, that we can't declare war on another country unless the UN Security Council says, okay, go ahead and do it.
Huh.
And the conservatives don't like that. It's a surrender of sovereignty. And it is. It truly is. But it's also a surrender of sovereignty when you sign the trade agreements. And they don't have any problem with that, because that helps multinational corporations rather than just preserving world peace, which is what the UN does. So anyhow, what we need to do is, just like the conservatives are saying, we need to walk away from the UN, which we could do. And like Bush said, we needed to walk away from the anti-ballistic missile treaty, which we did. He did. And he wanted to walk away from Kyoto, and he did. We need to walk away from these trade agreements. And we can. We can simply pull out of them and say, no thanks, we're not going to do it anymore. Got it?
All right. Thanks
okay.
a lot, Nate.
Thanks a lot, Nate. And tell your elected representatives. Beth in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Beth.
Hi. My son just returned from a tour of the Gulf. He's in the Coast Guard. His mission was river patrol up the southern part of Iraq. And he brought home some very revealing photos of the damage done from the first Gulf War. First of all, we haven't cleaned up our messes. But up and down this river are all the huge hulks of cargo ships and civilian ships that were, of course, bringing supplies to southern Iraq. So it opened my eyes up more to what our mission was in the first Gulf War, was to actually steal that river. And
yeah.
It would be like...
Well, that river was the access to the ports. I mean, that in part how a lot of the oil got out of there, was it not?
Yes, but everything. It would be like closing off the Mississippi and then just letting all those people starve and die.
In the interior of the United States.
Huh?
If you closed off the Mississippi port, then we couldn't export food from the center of the United States, and we couldn't bring imported goods into the center of the United States.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, but those photos were very revealing, because first of all, we haven't cleaned up our mess, but from my perspective, I've added up. But, you know, you have to look at the big picture. The first Gulf War embargo, now we've actually killed 1 million Iraqis trying to get this oil.
Over the last 12 years or so.
Yeah, a million
yeah.
civilians.
Yeah, yeah.
That kind of line.
In fact, it may
yeah.
be higher than that, because the estimates during the last 5 years of the the embargo was that 500,000 Iraqis were dying every year as a consequence of, you know, bad sanitation and things, because we wouldn't sell them chlorine, which is used in water treatment plants, because you can also use chlorine to make poison gas. And so they couldn't treat their water. But if your point is that in the first thing that we did when we attacked Iraq was seal their ports, it's a very telling point that right now we've got a UAE company buying our ports. I mean, you know, what kind of position does that put us in?
I heard that on the show the other day. But to me, it makes it very clear that this is genocide, and we have arrived. Fascism is here. It's not speculative anymore. We are here, and we're the Germans. The Iraqis are the Jews. It's that simple.
Yeah, it's increasingly certainly looking that way to the Iraqis, Beth.
Absolutely.
And that's why they're fighting back. Thank you for the call. Good to hear from you.
Okay.
Joe in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Joe.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Sure.
I was listening to an alternative talk show host. I listen to your show every day, but after a while there's about an hour break between talk shows, and I'm not going to mention his name, but he talked about the same thing you talked about, but he put a different spin on, and that's the trickle-down effect, how...
Right.
People over, you know, in the high income brackets will be spending the money they save on the tax breaks on, you know, like yachts and putting additions on their houses, and how that'll, you know, help.
Well, there is some truth to that. The problem is, though, that the vast majority of additional wealth for people is saved. You know, once you got $1 billion, what are you going to do with the second billion? You're not going to buy another yacht.
Foreign investments.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was just, it had to make me laugh, because he almost quoted you verbatim up to the point where he twisted it around and said it was a good thing.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
I say, I'm not going to mention his name. On this unfair trade agreements we're locked into, it's a security thing from my standpoint, because if you think about it, World War II just wasn't fought on the Pacific and European war fronts. It was fought here in the factories.
Here's, yeah, that's where the real security issue is, and that is that right now, Joe.
Steel mill during World War II.
Yeah, right now we can't make enough steel. We couldn't fight World War II right now if we had to. We can't make steel. We can't make battleships. We can't make a missile without computer chips from China, because they bought the last chip making machine and shipped it over there and reassembled it. I mean, it's absolutely bizarre. 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
I'm free.
And welcome back, my friends. 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. One of the folks in our chat room points out, Tom, it's not, the treaties are equal to the Constitution, not superior to it. Yes, if I indicated that a treaty could violate the Constitution, I was wrong. However, a treaty is superior to any law passed by the legislature, the federal or state law. And so therefore it's like equivalent to the Constitution. Or it's equivalent, it has that, you know, that level of strength. And that's, people don't get this, you know, when you talk about trade treaties and stuff like that. They just don't get it. Lee in Fairport, New York. Hey, Lee, welcome to the program.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. What's up, Lee?
Well, I have a news item here that has not been reported to my knowledge anywhere yet, and I thought you'd like to be the first to report it
okay.
on your show. Did you know that the state of California has enacted a resolution critical of the Patriot Act and calling for repeal of many of its sections that infringe on our civil liberties?
Oh, that's interesting. Although a resolution has no legal standing.
Well, this one does, because let me read you just one part of it. It requires that no state resources may be used for any action which violates the U.S. Constitution or the Constitution of California.
If it requires that, then it's not a resolution.
Well, they call it that. They call it the...
Well, then if they call it a resolution, then they can say requires all they want, but it doesn't have the force of law.
Well, I believe it does have the force of law. The ACLU in California can update you on that.
Really? Maybe the word resolution has a different meaning in California than other states I've lived in. I suppose I shouldn't be playing constitutional attorney here on a state-by-state level. or any level.
Well, this is very interesting because it specifically prohibits, and I'm quoting this part, recording, filing, or sharing of intelligence information concerning a person or organization, including library lending and research records, medical records, financial records, student records, and other personal data, even if authorized under the USA Patriot Act.
Interesting.
This is an extremely important development. I believe California's resolution calls upon all 55 members of its congressional delegation to work, you know, towards repeal of many of the sections of the Patriot Act that are coming up for renewal on March 10th.
Yeah, the part that concerns me the most is the ability of the Secret Service now to declare any area a special area of national significance, a SENS, and then go in and enforce their authority there.
Absolutely. This is something that was added. You know, there was a Senate committee that met on this to work out differences between the House of Representatives and the Senate.
Hmm.
And, of course, it was all Republican members, 100%.
Hmm.
And they worked out an agreement which supposedly adds protections.
Right.
But the reality is it's even worse than what we had before.
Yeah, it increases the power of government. And what is amazing to me, Lee, and Lee, thanks a lot for the call and for sharing that information. What amazes me is that traditionally the position of conservatives has been that they are afraid of government power. They don't like government power. They don't want government to have power. In fact, that is the whole position that they use. I mean, the traditional argument against, for example, Social Security. Oh, Social Security is just a way of making you dependent upon the government, increases government power. These liberals, they're going to buy your votes by giving you medical care. I mean, forget the fact that we live in a democracy. And so if we get together and say, you know, we've decided that we're going to use our tax dollars to create a giant insurance company to protect us all, and it's going to operate in our benefit rather than the benefit of some conservative or Republican corporate insurance companies, set aside that consideration. No, it's not about democracy. It's about we're going to buy your votes by giving you what you want. Do you get how weird the logic is that Limbaugh and these guys, all these right-wing talk show hosts are out there spewing out this stuff, and all these right-wing politicians? It's just absolutely bizarre. Anyhow, Michael in Antioch, California. Hey, Michael, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I just want to back up something somebody said earlier to you and tell you how important your voice is to the American people.
Okay.
I hope you realize how important it is. I read in the paper today a letter to the editor, and I didn't read the story that the letter was about, but, of course, the rumor's been around since we invaded Iraq that Saddam had moved his weapons of mass destruction to Syria. And I guess I just want to make a statement of how ridiculous that is, that Saddam knew that we were going to invade his country. He had weapons that could probably destroy any invading power, but he moved them instead of using them in this upcoming war.
Yeah, it's sort of like saying, you know, it's the Cold War, and the Soviet Union might blow us up, and so why don't we send our missiles to Mexico?
Yeah, I guess it's not a question, but I had to share it with you because I've heard it so often, it just does not make any sense. If this guy, you know, looked ahead and said, what I'll do instead of fighting them back with these weapons that I have is I'm going to go hide in what they call a spider hole, and then I'll let them capture me and put me to death. It's just not logical that a leader of any country, even
No,
Iraq.
If Saddam had shipped any weapons, I mean, we've got spy satellites that are capable of photographing a license plate. You know, we can almost read somebody's driver's license from outer space. There's absolutely no way, and this isn't, you know, some talk show host saying this. This is, you know, essentially right out of the CIA.
That's right.
There is no way that Saddam could have moved weapons of mass destruction out of that country, at least anything of any size, anything of any consequence, without our knowing about it. And particularly during that period of time, because we were just hypersensitive to what was going on. Michael, thank you for the call. Thanks for your kind words. Much appreciated. It's 56 minutes after the hour, 57 minutes after the hour. It's coming up on 3 minutes at the top of the hour. We'll be back after the news at the top of the hour, the place where smart people get their news. The Tom Hartman radio program. Got to tell you about what George W. Bush is saying about energy independence and the quick song and dance the Energy Department had to do to make him not look totally ridiculous. We'll be back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. For a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where smart people get their news. Welcome back. It's time for a...
What a friend we have in W.
What a friend we have in W alert.
Right, strong, and resolute.
Indeed. The federal government program.
God wished him to be our leader. The court could not but follow suit.
They just had no choice. the federal drug program, we're talking about Medicare here, has turned into, this, by the way, from a conservative commentary by Mike Adams, it's turned into a national nightmare that has left hundreds of thousands of low-income seniors without prescriptions and states actually owing the federal government hundreds of millions of dollars as payment for the fiasco. Five states have had enough. All right, it's Mike. California, Texas, Kentucky, New Jersey, and Missouri suing to block the federal government from billing them for the drugs that would have cost them even less under the old system. Yes. And W brought us this, W and the Republicans in Congress, of course. This mind-boggling program. For example, Tennessee Governor Phil Bresden. This guy's a Democrat, and he's going to show the people of Tennessee that he knows how to deal with the shortfall for his state's Medicaid program. Now, Medicaid and Medicare are two separate programs, but there's no overlap. Medicaid is the program for poor people in the state. Medicare is a different program. Faced with a $650 million shortfall to pay for his state's Medicaid program, Tennessee Governor Phil Bredesen cut 191,000 low-income people from the plan. I just cut them loose. You know, they're just poor people. Odds are they're not going to vote, and if they do, then we'll figure out a way to keep them from voting. You know, maybe they don't have driver's licenses, or maybe they're moving, or maybe they don't have a residence, and we're going to ask for a utility. We want to see their cable TV bill. That's how we'll know that they're really registered. If they can't afford cable TV, they can't vote. That's that simple. Tennessee is the only state that won't pay to cover a widely used class of anti-seizure medications for 560,000 poor adult Medicaid enrollees. They also won't cover eight other types of drugs. This is, by the way, from Knight Ritter, an article by Tony Pugh. The headline, Tennessee's move to cut health care costs raises national eyebrows. The moves may burnish Bredesen's reputation for cost-cutting, but there's widespread concern that people who can't afford to buy the anti-seizure drugs on their own will suffer in silence or end up in emergency rooms across the state. Bredesen, who's running for re-election, is also trying to develop public-private partnerships to cover 600,000 poor people who can't afford coverage on their own. Yes. You know, it was Teddy Roosevelt who said... It was Harry Truman who said that when the American people are confronted with a choice between voting for a Republican or a Democrat who acts like a Republican, they will choose the Republican every time. Now, it's not to say that Harry Truman thought the American people preferred Republicans. His point was, let's be honest about what we're all about. This is Bill Clinton, same thing. Well, let's reform welfare. And as a result, in part, of Clinton's reform of welfare, and in larger part, the consequence of 25 years of conservative economic policies, we now have here in the United States, as Paul Harris in Kentucky, in the Observer, the Guardian, the publication, the UK publication, it's called the Guardian, I think the Observer is their Sunday publication. The headline, 37 million poor, hidden in the land of plenty. Americans have always believed, writes Paul Harris, that hard work will bring rewards, but vast numbers now cannot meet their bills even with two or three jobs. You get this is how the rest of the world sees us. This is in a British paper. More than one in ten citizens in the United States live below the poverty line, and the gap between the haves and the have-nots is widening. He writes, a shocking 37 million Americans live in poverty. This is 12.7% of the population, the highest percentage in the developed world. Every year since 2001, their number has grown. Well, gee, what happened in 2001? Let's see. Oh, that was the year that George W. Bush became president. I'd forgotten. Under President George W. Bush, an extra 5.4 million jobs have slipped below the poverty line. You get this? Bush is out there running around saying, you know, we're going to make jobs. We're going to make jobs. We're going to create jobs. Don't worry. We're going to make jobs. In fact, he even went so far and, you know, early on in 2002 to say that if we gave a $500,000 tax break to billionaires and millionaires, that with that $500,000, they might create one job. Now, I'm serious. If you divide $550 billion by a million, you get 550,000. So if you create a million jobs for $550 billion, or here's the clip. Oop, hang on just a second. Try it again.
$550 billion with a robust package of at least $550 billion in across-the-board tax relief. We will help create more than a million new jobs.
Now, you do the math on that. I mean, just pull out your little calculator and put 550,000,000,000,000 and divide it by one with six zeros after it, and it comes out to $550,000 per job. Now, the way that Franklin Roosevelt would back in the day, when there were no jobs, you had 32-33% unemployment, a third of Americans were not working, and you couldn't just say to a company, hey, build a factory. The way that he created jobs was he said, okay, we're going to be the employer of last resort. So we're going to go to unemployed people and we're going to say, you know, there's a hillside over there that got clear cut. And we need to replant that hillside because the soil is running off and it's polluting the streams and we need to have a forest there. So we're going to use tax dollars, we're going to use government money to pay you to replant that forest. Or we've got bridges we need to build. Or we have roads that need to be built. Or even for the unemployed artists, we have murals that need to be painted in our office building, our government office buildings. And by giving these people jobs, they now had money in their pocket. And what did they do with that money? They spent it. And to create each one of those jobs didn't cost $550,000. To create each one of those jobs cost, well, in today's dollars, maybe $15,000 or $20,000. Or maybe even, I'd say $10,000 or $15,000. These were low-wage jobs. But they were something. But Bush, ever since we got the $550 billion tax cut,
with a robust package of at least $550 billion in across-the-board tax relief, we will help create more than a million new jobs.
Ever since we got that $550 billion tax cut, we have seen 5.5 million workers in America slip below the poverty line. As they note, The Guardian, most have jobs. Many have two. They note, even families with two working parents are often one slice of bad luck, one medical bill or factory closure away from disaster. The minimum wage of $5.15 an hour has not risen since 1997, and adjusted for inflation is at its lowest since 1956. Bush's trillion-dollar federal budget deficit recently raised massive amounts of defense spending for the war in Iraq and slashed billions from welfare programs. And then they quote John Edwards talking about the reality of this. And they say, in fact, Edwards is right. He said, during the 2004 election, the only politician to address poverty directly was John Edwards, whose campaign theme was Two Americas. He was derided by Republicans for doing down the country and after for speaking poor of the country. And after John Kerry picked him as his Democratic running mate, his rhetoric softened in the heat of the campaign. But in fact, Edwards was right. While 45.8 million Americans lack any health insurance, the top 20% of earners will take over half the national income. At the same time, the bottom 20% took home just 3.4%. 3.4% of all of our income for the bottom 20%, the bottom fifth of Americans, and the top fifth of Americans, over half of all of the income in the United States. This is very, very substantial stuff. I mean, we have in the United States Save the Children. You see these ads on TV. Here's Sally Struthers. Well, I don't think it's Sally anymore, but you see these TV ads that, oh, we've got to feed the starving children. Save the Children. They're functioning in the United States. It's a tragedy. It's an absolute tragedy. And we have the last four presidents to thank for it. Lyndon Johnson came along and he cut poverty in the United States in half in 4 years with the war on poverty. An entire generation of African Americans, in large part, and people in Appalachia, poor white people, had an opportunity to go to college who'd never had it before. And a middle class was born.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
It's good to be king, just for a while. To be there in velvet, yeah, to give them a smile.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 21 minutes past the hour. Yeah, it's good to be king, you know.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
Yeah. Oh, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy. Mike Labelman is the founder of the Center for Urban Agriculture at Fairview Gardens, an education center and working organic farm in Southern California. He's our Bioneers guest this week. Founded in 1990, Bioneers is a nonprofit organization that promotes practical environmental solutions and innovative social strategies for restoring the earth and communities. Bioneers.org is their website. Michael's website, fieldsofplenty.com. Hey, Michael, welcome to the program.
Nice to be with you.
Glad to have you here. This is incredible to me. There's all kinds of folks running around talking about peak oil and economic disaster, and I'm one of them. And that what may come out of this could be, frankly, agricultural disaster as well. The inability of people to feed themselves. And you are feeding over 500 families, employing 20 people, hosting 5,000 people a year for tours, classes, festivals, and apprenticeships. And you're doing this on 12 and a half acres?
That's right, yeah. I mean, it's a pretty remarkable, often referred to as the little farm that could. It's pretty incredible what is possible, and certainly a lot of my work now is trying to get this model out there for people to see and to replicate. And,
how do you produce over 100 different fruits and vegetables on 12 and a half acres?
Well, you know, it's amazing. We have a fairly narrow view of what is possible agriculturally until you go to places like China and see that some of the traditional forms of agriculture there where they were traditionally, not now, feeding their entire population on 11% of the entire land base. And they did that by some very creative, incredibly complex, intensive farming systems where, for example, here an orchard is not just an orchard. There are row crops planted down the alleys of the trees. There is multi-cropping. In other words, instead of one crop developing in a field, there may be two or three at the same time at different stages.
Mm-hmm.
It's just kind of challenging our view of what a farm really is and rethinking that and trying to come up with creative means to grow food closer to where people live. I think that's pretty critical as well right now. So.
Now, you're located in British Columbia. I mean, you're north of pretty much anybody in the United States, although you're on the coast there, aren't you? You don't get snow.
The farm you described is in California, I ran that project. I'm still involved with it for the last 25 years. But I have a family farm in British Columbia, which is not, I have not attempted to replicate the the urban nature of the Fairview Gardens project. So it's very different up there, of course.
So the Fairview Gardens one is where?
It's just it's north of L.A., about an hour and a half, north of Santa Barbara, California.
You said it's urban. Is it in a city?
Well, if you looked at it from the air, it's virtually an island, a 12.5-acre island floating in a sea of tract homes and shopping centers. And it's, it's been preserved in perpetuity under one of the first active agricultural conservation easements in the country, which gives the land a voice. There's a document attached to the title that it can only be farmed in the future. These little islands and oases are, the primary component of most developments in America now is the automobile,
right?
The swimming pool, and I think that
the yard. I mean, why don't we turn our yards into gardens?
Well, exactly. I mean, I believe that every new development should be required to have a working farm to feed the population that will exist in those houses. It should be at least as important as the lawn or the swimming pool, and certainly the lawns are. It's an incredible. The amount of resources and energy required to maintain a little patch of grass is kind of ridiculous when we could be producing food.
And when there's 30, 40, 50,000 people a day starving all around the planet, it seems beyond ridiculous. It seems immoral, frankly. We, particularly given the agricultural output of this country. So are you suggesting that individuals with their homes could grow a significant portion of their food with your basic, quarter acre or half acre lot?
No question about it. I mean, the possibilities are unbelievable. And there are some wonderful the great thing is that this is not just some idea.
You've done it. Can you do this in places where there's snow? Can they
exactly.
do this in Minnesota?
I mean, people accused me. There was some magazine interview years ago after I had moved to British Columbia, and they said, well, why is it that whenever I hear someone waxing poetically about regional food, they always come from Southern California? And I was able to answer that. First of all, I'm living in Canada now, and I have discovered not only in my own work but a number of other models around the country where people are producing an incredibly diverse diet in very northern places where throughout the year places like coastal Maine and Wisconsin, places you wouldn't think about year-round production, are very possible. Now we've really learned a lot about extending seasons and about food storage and et cetera. So.
Yeah, remarkable. Michael Abelman. And the website is fieldsofplenty.com. He's the founder and Center for Urban Agriculture at Fairview Gardens. Michael, thank you for being with us and sharing this message.
My pleasure.
Great speaking with you. Fieldsofplenty.com. Check it out. Absolutely amazing. The potential. What you can do. It's amazing. It's 27 minutes past the hour. I'm John Martin.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Truth and common sense in broadcast. Let me just lay out a few of these numbers for you. I mean, just very simple stuff. We started out the program 2.5 hours ago talking about the state of the economy in the context of these ports being bought out by these Arab companies, by this, this whole let's sell out the ports to the United Arab Emirates. And it's really easy for the xenophobes and for the Islamophobes and for the racists among us to go, oh, we can't have Arabs running them, or the 9/11 phobes. Oh, they've got something to do with 9/11. The big story that's not being discussed is the selling out of America, regardless of who it's being sold out to. Let me just share with you the numbers on what's happened since Ronald Reagan became president. Since Reagan became president and declared war on the American middle class, and the first major shot fired in that war was in 1982 when he fired PATCA, the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Association, and the Air Traffic Controllers Union. That was the beginning of it. And now we see, these are figures that are pulled together oddly enough, from the American Conservative magazine. Home mortgage debt has risen from $1.8 trillion when Reagan came into office to $8.2 trillion today. Consumer debt has risen from $2.7 trillion when Reagan came into office to $11 trillion today. Household debt has quadrupled. The personal savings rate of Americans has gone from 11% to minus 1% last year. The U.S. federal budget deficit during the Reagan administration reached $2 trillion. It was less than $1 trillion when he came into office. It's now over $8 trillion. The U.S. trade deficit has gone from around $150 billion per year under Reagan to over $726 billion over the past year. If you just look at the last 20 years, that's over $3 trillion. Of trade deficit. In other words, we've had to sell off $3 trillion worth of America to balance that bill. It's like if your income doesn't equal your expenses, what do you got to do? Start selling stuff off. You got to sell off the CDs, you sell off the stereo, you sell off the furniture. I mean, that's what we're doing. $11 trillion in U.S. assets are now held in foreign hands, roughly 20% of all U.S. assets. Look around you. One-fifth of America is now owned by people outside the United States or corporations or governments. One-fifth of U.S. assets. The U.S. has collectively borrowed over $10 trillion since Reagan came into office. Now, consider for a minute. If you wanted to make, for example, the economy of India. They're actually larger than we are. There's a billion people in India. There's only 300 million more or less here. Let's say you want to make the economy of India look really good. If you borrowed $10 trillion and gave it to India and said, spend this money, you think that country would look good? Keep in mind, that's $10,000 billion or $10 million. I think that you could make the country look pretty good. If you took $10 trillion and gave it to Mexico or Mexico and Canada, their economies would suddenly look very healthy. Our economy, the only thing that has held our economy together since Ronald Reagan started deconstructing it in his Starve the Beast strategy to destroy our social programs, to take apart the New Deal, his war on Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal.
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
In the time since Ronald Reagan declared war on the American working class and the American people and on Roosevelt's programs, from that time to this time, from Reagan coming into office until today, we have borrowed $10 trillion, and the government has spent it, and that is the only thing that has kept our economy looking like it's actually an economy. Not just the government having borrowed it. Excuse me. You and I have borrowed it. We borrowed it on our credit cards. We borrowed it against our homes. The government has borrowed a good chunk of it. $10 trillion of debt. We are now the most indebted nation on earth. And this was all done in the name of destroying socialism. This was all done in the name of undoing the New Deal, because they knew, the conservatives knew, that they couldn't simply go in and deconstruct the New Deal. They couldn't go in and say, okay, no more minimum wage laws, no more child labor laws, no more unemployment insurance, no more Social Security. No more maximum hour laws. No more 40-hour week. No more right to unionize. They knew they couldn't go in and say those. They see, none of these things existed before Roosevelt became president. They knew they couldn't simply go in and say, okay, we're going to take all this stuff from the New Deal that created the American middle class, the greatest middle class arguably the world has ever seen. Although I'll tell you, Sweden is, and the other so-called socialist Nordic countries, these are democracies. where the people simply say, no, you know, we'd kind of like to have it like the United States did in the 50s and 60s and 70s. In fact, we'll even go better. We're going to do what Harry Truman said, what Franklin Roosevelt thought about. We're going to have national health care as well. They knew, these cons knew, Bush, Reagan, Rush, they knew, Frist, they knew that if they came out and said what their agenda was, Grover Norquist, if they came out and told the truth about what they were up to, they'd be kicked out so fast their heads would spin. They would vanish from office. Every now and then they'll come out and say it. They'll just brag about it.
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
Every now and then it slips out, but by and large, they'd really rather talk about, let's stop gays from adopting children. Let's stop gays from getting married. Let's stop poor people from voting. Let's stop people from burning flags. It's the classic, you know, don't look at that man behind the curtain. Pay no attention.
Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain.
Yeah, you can't know about that. And, you know, Bin Laden, one day he's public enemy number one, and the next day, well...
So I don't know where he is. Nor, you know, I just don't spend that much time on him, really, to be honest with you. Again, I don't know where he is. I repeat what I said. I truly am not that concerned about him.
And if you're confused, then, you know, we'll just really confuse you a little bit more. You know?
When we talk about war, we're really talking about peace.
You see, George Orwell told you that. Now I'm telling you the same thing. It's, war is peace. So, anyhow, I suppose that's enough of that rant. It seems so important to say this on a regular basis, that the conservatives have spent us into debt. They have sold off this country. 20% of this country no longer belongs to Americans. They have sold off this country so that their corporate, their multinational corporate friends in Walmart can be profitable. And they have driven us into debt in the hopes of destroying social programs that they really and truly, deep down in their hearts, thought were bad things. What you're seeing here is that the road to hell is paved with good intentions, right? I mean, these are cons who really and truly think that Social Security and Medicare are bad things because they're bad for America. I'm not questioning their patriotism. I'm questioning the content of their actions, the consequences of their actions. And the tragic reality is that when you look around the world, you see that every time a country has gone in the direction of these conservative economic programs, every time, it has ended up like the world that Charles Dickens wrote about so eloquently. Charles Dickens, whose father was put into debtor's prison.
Mr. Scrooge, may I have a lump of coal? No, you can't. It'll cost me an extra pence. Get back to work. Tiny Tim needs health care. Forget it.
Unless a ghost shows up. David in Blaine, Washington. Hey, David, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, it's always such an honor to talk to you, and your show is incredible. All the more reason for us to implement some sort of a debt forgiveness program.
Yeah, we need a jubilee.
Global debt forgiveness.
Yeah, we need a global jubilee. The Old Testament, you go back, every 7 years, you know, there were the second, and every seven times 7 years, every 50 years, basically, the 49th year, the 50th year, all debt was forgiven, all slaves were freed, and
That's
all
right.
wealth was normalized.
That's
and
right.
it was a way of maintaining, and this, the people actually did this for, you know, a couple thousand years. It was a way of maintaining a social structure from generation to generation that didn't rigidify into a caste system.
That's right. You know, and reinstate a new precious metals-backed currency all over the planet.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that. The only problem is with a precious, well, you know, actually, I was going to say, the only problem with a precious metal-backed currency is that then the entire world's economy is hostage to those who mine and control the quantity of the
though.
Precious metal.
Not necessarily, though.
Yeah, I understand. And that's a debate.
That's the iceberg.
Yeah, that's a debate we should have some other time, David. But
okay.
Good point. In fact, I've got to get somebody on who wants to talk about gold one of these days, and we'll get into it in some detail. David, thanks for the call. It's good to hear from you. It's 45 minutes past the hour. $10 trillion. You understand what that means? Tom Hartman here with you, exposing the con and conservative.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Have a nice day.
And welcome back to the place where being progressive never felt so good. Well, you know, sometimes knowing what's going on doesn't make you feel all that great. But on the other hand, knowing what's going on is the necessary first step to fixing it. And that's what we're doing here. We're trying to fix the problems in this country by talking, you know, just laying out. Here's $10 trillion we borrowed over the last 25 years to make the economy look good. And now, in the meantime, George Bush, he's coming on. This is incredible. He's today he's at this energy place, this company that yesterday he was visiting a company that makes solar panels, and today he's at kind of this think tank, right, this national think tank on alternative energy. And it turns out that, well, this is a story from the Washington Post. And it's just amazing. I mean, they just lay this stuff. It's just like out there laying around on the ground, these jewels. The Energy Department said it has come up with $5 million to immediately restore job cuts at a renewable energy laboratory President George W. Bush will visit on Tuesday, avoiding a potentially embarrassing moment as the president promotes his energy plan. Yeah, you got it right. The National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Golden, Colorado, which is in fact actually operated by a private contractor, who had to take, you know, they take their piece off the top. And they, the Department of Energy had to, over the weekend, over the holiday weekend, over the President's Day holiday weekend, they had to get together and come up with $5 million to give to the Midwest Research Institute, the contractor that operates this lab, so that they could rehire these 36 people who were due to have their jobs cut at the end of this month because of budget shortfalls. So when George Bush walks around, nobody would say, he's being a hypocrite. Is your mind boggled yet? It's incredible. It's incredible. Susan in Santa Cruz, California. Hey, Susan, welcome to the program.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I agree with you, the way that we're selling off our resources. I just wanted to mention how RWE did a huge German conglomerate worth $57 billion. In 2002, they came over and the water system, 800 water systems throughout America, they paid $2.8 billion over the asking price because they wanted this water. Now, I live in Shelton. It's a little teeny town above Santa Cruz. They have 1,350 customers. They raised the rates 54% to 80% when they came in. Now, we had to close two schools down in our little area because of lack of funds, and our school uses $50,000 worth of water a year, so 80% hit our schools. That got me into it. I was very upset. They also can bottle water, and they're very political. They've made local contributions to our local politicians, and they're German. They can't even vote. And they're also protected by the World Trade Organization. So if by chance they did want to make money and we say, oh, you can't, then our state could get sued. And they own 800 companies. Like if you're in New York, it's called New York American. If you're in Arizona, it's Arizona America. Well, out here it's called Cal American. It's California American.
And it's a German company.
It's a German company. They're into nuclear waste. They have 4 nuclear power plants in Germany, and they fire them up with their own coal companies. Greenpeace has fined them as being the largest CO2 polluters in the world with these brown coal plants. And Germany now is going to phase out all of their nuclear power by 2020 because it is so filthy, and they have no more place to put the nuclear waste. This German company is dumping it in Kazakhstan. People don't realize, and even in the Russians don't even realize, in Kazakhstan, they don't realize that this nuclear waste, they also got cited for dumping nuclear waste in the Northern Sea nuclear waste in the Northern Sea because there's no place to dump this. So when Bush starts pushing nuclear power, it's because our companies went in after Russia went down. They went into places like Kazakhstan, and they're raping it for uranium, plutonium. And so now Cheney and all of these guys, Halliburton went in there, General Elect, everything went in there, Kazakhstan. They're going to sell this stuff to us. So when they say they're doing nuclear power plants, it's because they want to, they can make money off of this stuff.
Sure, sure.
So now these guys are in our water, and they have bad service. They raise the rates. They're very underhanded. They put out a lot of misinformation. So Felton got together, this teeny little town that has been really bullied heavy by these people. They put out a bond last year for $11 billion, and they passed it. 75% of the people said they wanted these people out, and they would go ahead and right out of their pocketbooks, they would pay to get these people out of
here. This town tried to buy back their water supply from the German
government. They're trying to buy back their water supply, and we have San Lorenzo Valley Water District, a little teeny water district that's in our area, said they would take over. This is what we're trying to do, but the battle is still on. It's in the legal, it's in the courts, and it's but Felton is one of the biggest fighters I've ever seen take over corporate World Trade backed huge German conglomerate.
Amazing.
I'd like to see more of America do this. It's been heartbreaking. I'm so burned out by doing this that I've had to kind of pull out of it for a while because I just couldn't sleep at night. And the amount of corruption and lying going on here, if America knew, and this is our water.
Yeah.
This is our water.
Yeah, this is absolutely incredible. Susan, thanks for the call, and thanks for sensitizing us to that. It's an interesting story. That, along with this, radiation detectors in Britain recorded a fourfold increase in uranium levels in the atmosphere after the shock and awe bombing campaign in Iraq. Why? Because the winds were blowing toward Europe from Iraq. All that depleted uranium, which came from nuclear waste, which we dumped on Iraq, was showing up in Europe. A fourfold increase in uranium in the air. Coming up on the next Tom Hartmann program, conservative Rusty Weller says the Constitution bans women from running for president. What? Is this the new con thing? Jeffrey Feldman says to the Bush administration, leadership first, vacations later. Is PTSD skyrocketing in vets? That's more in vets. That and more and your calls on the next Tom Hartmann program. Remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartmann Program. Check our website at www.tomhartmann.com for archives of this program and more information.